Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Yesterday, a major storm roiled the surface of the sun and sent a shotgun blast of charged particles hurtling toward the Earth. It hits today and could affect electronic equipment and light up the skies with an aurora visible as far south as Pennsylvania. The star that brings us life can bring death as well. Today, we're going to talk about its changing moods and how they impact us all. This hour on Point, the mysteries and the science of the sun. Please join the conversation. Have you ever seen a solar eclipse, the Northern Lights, and wondered how it all works? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And on our website, you can also see a video of yesterday's big solar flare. It's pretty exciting. Joining me now from Woodstock, New York, is Bob Berman. He's a longtime astronomy columnist. He writes the Strange Universe column for Astronomy Magazine. He's also the science editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac. And his latest book is called The Sun's Heartbeat and Other Stories from the Life of the Star That Powers Our Planet. Bob Berman, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jackie.
It's a pleasure to have you here with us, and as we are having this solar flare.
Oh, yeah, it's great to be here. Great to be here. It's an exciting topic.
Bob Berman, you've been an astronomer for, what, 30 years? What was your attitude towards the sun in the beginning, and how's it changed?
Well, I hated it at first. I mean, to tell you the truth, the sun was the enemy of the night. It erased all the galaxies and all the cool stuff that I thought was really the heart and soul of astronomy. And when I used to teach college astronomy, I gave it short shrift, spend a few days talking about the sun. But as it evolved that I was destined to write this book about the sun for Little Brown, they say the best way to learn about anything is to write a book about it, and it became more and more amazing as I researched it more and more. So I'm as excited as hopefully the readers of The Sun's Heartbeat will be.
Give us some basic sun stats. How big is it? How far away?
Well, the famous figure is 93 million miles away. That actually was the very first million-dollar question in Who Wants to Be a Millionaire back then. The first one that was answered successfully. And, of course, I shouted at the TV screen, C, choice C, it's 93 million. And a lot of people know that. Size, about 860,000 miles in diameter, about enough so that if you were dropping Earths in at the rate of, it would take over a million Earths to fit inside the sun. So it's big.
But you say there's something about the sun. I mean, if anything, the sun has become a bit demonized. Stay out of the sun. And in this book, you explore every aspect. And you say, you know, part of the reason that we don't know more and don't think about it perhaps in more positive ways, and of course we desperately need sunshine, is that we see it all the time and that familiarity is often the enemy of this kind of interest and excitement.
Yes, it is, of course. Pretty magical things that surround us in life, like fire and water and the sun, we dismiss them with a single word. Of course, the word water is not water, and the sun is this ball of fire. And I don't know how many people, not very many, realize that there's a ball of fire that crosses the sky every day. And really kind of pick up on how amazing that is, the way people in primitive times did.
They certainly venerated it in the Mayan culture, the Aztec culture, the Egyptian culture. And why do you think we've sort of, I mean, obviously scientists are studying it, but when you came to write this book, were you surprised at how little we know? For example, you said something in the book about the fact that the color green in our grass stays greener as the sun goes down, and whereas red washes out because of the way the sun's rays refract on the earth.
Yeah, we do a whole chapter about how what we see is an interplay of course, our own brain-eye system and what's actually out there. And there are a lot of quirks in our vision. They all start off with sunlight because we were designed by nature to see by the energies given off by the sun. In other words, there's no X-rays bouncing around on the rocks and the objects all around us in life, so we're blind to them. We see exactly those wavelengths that the sun emits most strongly. And if you ask most people, well, what's the sun's strongest emission? People might guess, well, maybe it's ultraviolet, the stuff that burns us at the beach, or maybe it's infrared heat that you could feel. But the strongest emission, as you just suggested, is green. The sun gives off more green light than any other single component. And this gives us a green bias in life and really affects the things that we see. Although grass, when we look at grass or leaves or the botanical world, it'd be logical to think, well, that must like green. It must take in and feed on the green component of sunlight. But in truth, grass and plants and leaves hate green light. They feed on mostly the sun's blue light, and they'll also take in red to a lesser extent, but they don't like green. I don't know why. Chlorophyll is averse to green. So what we're seeing around us when we look at a lawn is the part of the sun's wavelengths, the green, that's being rejected and reflected away. It's the color that the grass doesn't want. So, and that's why we see it as green.
That's beautiful. Bob Berman, give us an explanation. How was the sun formed? Maybe a lot of people know, but I think a lot of us would like to learn.
It started out as a cloud of gas and a little bit of dust thrown in. And, of course, the poetic part of that is that the sun was the product of the marriage of two disparate entities, this cloud of mostly hydrogen, a little bit of helium thrown in, and a supernova that went off in our quadrant of the galaxy. A blue star had exploded, and stars that are supernovae produce all of the elements, whereas a nebula just has essentially hydrogen and helium. So this new stuff came in and had all the interesting materials that are in our bodies at this moment in our planet, the oxygen and the carbon and the iron and the other things that was not there. So it was a mixture of the two. And in fact, that supernova was the product of a star that was made of a previous generation of stars that had exploded. So our sun is a third-gen star, third-generation star made up of the sort of like a factory where each generation of stars enriches what was there before. And so as a result, that nebula collapsed and rotated and became our sun.
It's been a wild week in the news. Can we count on the sun being around for a long time?
Well, yeah, we think another 5 billion years as changing so little that if you were an alien that visited the solar system and then came back in 5 billion years, it would look pretty much the same. But unfortunately for us, we only have about 1.1 billion years left before it toasts our planet and makes us uninhabitable. And that's a shame because life has been on Earth for almost 4 billion years. And to think that we only have 1 billion years left is almost almost depressing. The famous joke.
I was trying to be upbeat.
Well, yeah, you know, there's a famous joke among astronomers where a student raises their hand and says, "Professor, did you just say that the sun is going to make life uninhabitable on Earth in just 1 million years?" And the professor says, "No, 1 billion years." And the student says, "Oh, whew. Thank goodness. I thought you said 1 million years. So we don't really have to worry about it. But 1 million years, see, the sun consistently gets 10% hotter every billion years. It's been doing this since it was born. So even when there was life in the early Earth, the sun was 30% cooler than it is now. And it's of great interest that there could have even been life on this should have been frozen planet, but we had so many more greenhouse gases back then, methane and things like that, that it made up for the sun's youthful anemia. And as a result, the Earth is pretty much the same temperature as it was. But in 1 billion years, there's nothing we can do about it. You'd think 10% hotter would be, we could get used to it. It'd be a little bit like moving from Boston to Atlanta. 10% doesn't sound like much, but all the calculations show that at that point, Earth will be 700 degrees year-round. Air conditioning will be standard on cars, not just optional. And the oceans will have boiled away, and that will be that. So that's our future. We have only a billion years left of mischief to do.
You also talk a lot about sunspots in this book, and I was fascinated at that became a astronomical debate, if you will, between observers like Galileo and others. What's a sunspot?
Yes, exactly right. That was the question at first. And it was fun that the early observers, Galileo and a Jesuit priest named Scheiner, used to have these angry debates. They were like Woody Allen dialogues where they'd put each other down in public. Scheiner would say, after Galileo said that they are on the surface, and Shiner would say, now, who would say such a thing, that it's that there are spots on the sun? And Galileo would reply in print, anybody who's observed it and wants to say anything intelligent about it would say that, because Shiner thought they were just little dots above the sun's surface. So, but nobody knew what they were until a good century had passed. And the big clue was in the 1800s, late 1800s, when we found that every sunspot is a place of intense magnetism, where the magnetism is locally 3,000 times stronger than the magnetism on the rest of the sun, which is, by the way, about as strong as the magnetism on Earth. So the sun generally doesn't have a very strong magnetic field, except in these little spots. So the magnetism stops the material from under the surface from rising up, and since it slows it down, it makes it cooler. And so those are little areas where the sun is a little bit cooler and hence darker than the rest of the sun. And you'd think that with all those dark spots on the sun, every 11 years or so we get periods when the sun is really has a lot of spots, you'd think the sun would be cooler. But it isn't. It's actually hotter then, with lots of consequences.
Okay. This is On Point. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the sun, its life, its burning heart, and how it governs our lives. And we're joined this hour by Bob Berman. He's a longtime astronomy columnist and author of the new book, The Sun's Heartbeat and Other Stories from the Life of the Star That Powers Our Planet. And Bob, we got a great call at the break, so I would like to introduce you to Ken, who is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Welcome to On Point, Ken.
Hi, Jackie. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely.
I was intrigued by Bob Berman's comment that plants don't like green light, and he wasn't quite sure why. And I figured an astronomer might wonder about that. But a biologist wouldn't.
Which you are? Okay, great.
And I'm a professor of biology at Brown. And here's the reason why. The envelope of visible light that hits the Earth goes, as Bob knows, all the way from blue up to the far red. If you had a molecule that had a single absorption peak in green, then green light would be the only thing it could absorb. But the genius of chlorophyll is that it has two absorption peaks, one in the blue and one in the far red. And to a physicist, the far red peak is what's called the first excited singlet state, and the blue one is the second excited singlet state. So the way chlorophyll is set up, it actually has a double absorption peak, both wavelengths of light, and that enables it to absorb basically the maximum amount of light that a single molecule could. It's almost perfect for the light that hits the surface of the Earth.
I love this.
Me too.
And Bob, if you designed a green pigment, not only would it change the color of plants, they'd look really different, but it wouldn't be quite as efficient as chlorophyll because chlorophyll has two peaks instead of one.
I love this. I love you.
Ken.
I always wondered about this, and you just answered it.
There you go.
Ken, thank you. Thank you so much. That's a good one for all of us gardeners. I'd also like to have another person join the conversation. We're speaking with Madhulika Guhathakurta, and she's a NASA astrophysicist, an expert on heliophysics and space weather. She's also the lead scientist for NASA's Living with a Star initiative, which focuses on understanding the effects of solar variability on technology and human life. Madhulika Guhathakurta, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Jackie.
What is space weather and heliophysics?
Thanks for asking that question. I've been wanting to talk about it for a long time. So very simply put, I'll start with space weather. Space weather describes events that happen in space which can disrupt modern technologies. And space weather, if I can draw an analogy, is kind of like terrestrial weather, except the physics governing it is very different. Now, when we talk about terrestrial weather, we use the science of meteorology really to describe many different kinds of phenomena, whether it's rain or snow, precipitation, hurricanes, cyclones, etc. Well, similarly, heliophysics is that integrated science that describes the phenomenon like space weather. Heliophysics is much broader and richer than just explaining space weather, but you have to understand heliophysics to describe space weather. Hmm. And so heliophysics consists of disciplines like solar physics, ionospheric physics, atmospheric physics, magnetospheric physics, all these disciplines combined together, where we look at the sun as a variable star and we try to determine its interconnectedness with the interplanetary medium and every object in the solar system, most importantly, our own planet.
So, Madhulika, are you going to be looking then today at the solar flare and thinking, are you assessing it for its effect on technology?
You bet. We are on it, and there are two different ways we look at it. So at NASA, what we have are several different spacecraft, a fleet actually. Today, they are actually surrounding the sun, so there is no part on the sun that is invisible to us anymore. We can actually see all parts of the sun almost three-dimensionally because of the spacecraft like STEREO, Solar Dynamics Observatory, and then we have spacecraft like ACE that is very close to us in around the sun Earth line, where we can actually measure the particles that come out from the sun during a solar storm. So we have on one side NOAA, Space Weather Prediction Center, whose official job is to be the forecaster for the nation to say what kind of events are taking place, what kind of radiation we are going to be exposed to, what are the consequences. So they provide national forecast for all of us. On the NASA side, we look at all of this data and we try to understand the science behind it and see how good can we get with regard to our forecasting. We have ways to go, but we are watching it and modeling it.
All right. Thank you. We are talking about the sun in this hour. Let's go to a call. Jay is calling from Chesapeake, Virginia. Welcome to On Point, Jay.
Thank you very much. A couple years ago, a summer movie called 2012 proposed the idea that in 2012, the sun was supposed to go through a series of solar flares that have never before been seen in the history of mankind. What are your thoughts on these flares, and what would be the worst-case scenario? And I'll hang up and listen to the radio for your response. Thank you.
It was ridiculous, of course. which one of us would you like
to go right ahead, Bob. What do you think?
Well, 2012, it was entertaining, but it was silly, of course. Now, the sun does have explosions, especially coronal mass ejections. And in 1859 and 1921, these were so strong that if we got something like this today, it would indeed cause amazing amounts of damage. There are some estimates that we could have up to $2 trillion worth of damage on our high voltage lines, and satellites would be knocked out, and GPS would be degraded, and all sorts of terrible consequences. But the idea that it would then cause earthquakes within the Earth and mass destruction and the ocean rising and that kind of thing, no, that was entirely movie and fiction stuff.
And if I may kind of continue along that,
yes,
because
Madhulika,
this is a question we get kind of on a daily basis as well. It is kind of too bad that the prediction of the next solar cycle peak was supposed to be 2012. And so, of course, people kind of use that concept to say all hell is going to break loose. Well, that's not the case. For one, solar cycle peak is not likely to be in 2012. We've been in the midst of an unusual solar minimum and just barely kind of rising above. The second point I want to make is that the sun is always producing these kind of storms, whether it is going through its peak or declining phase or ascending phase, or even sometimes in minimum. In fact, the 1859 storm that Bob just talked about didn't happen during a very strong solar cycle, nor was it at the peak of the solar cycle. So I think we should pay attention to the sun irrespective of its cycle, because it can throw one of these, what we call, low probability but high impact solar storm, which can potentially cause a huge geomagnetic storm with all the lethal consequences that one can think of. But again, we have to take that in the same spirit as a 100-year flood or earthquake or something like that.
Although we have seen those things now, low probability, high impact, what a phrase. We're talking about the sun, its heartbeat, and its effect on us and its effect on technology. Let's take a call. Leo is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Welcome to On Point, Leo.
Hello, Jackie. My question is about the space weather satellite that detects the size and direction of the coronal mass ejection. Now, my understanding is that it's like 14 years old, and they have not authorized a replacement. And without that, we cannot get an early warning of a severe catastrophic flare.
All right. Thank you, Leo. Mahalika?
I can take that question, and that is, I think, what the caller is referring to is the ACE spacecraft as Advanced Composition Explorer. It is true, it's an old spacecraft, but it is still healthy and moving forward with a lot of fuel reserve. You know, if I may say so, we at NASA build satellites that can last for a long, long time. Voyager spacecraft are case in point. They are still chugging along, almost teetering at the edge of interstellar medium. But what I want to point out is that ACE is not the only satellite that's out there to give us long-term forecasting. What ACE does is really captures particles at about 1 million miles from Earth. So at that point, if we can measure these particles at ACE, we can be very sure that something either catastrophic is either going to happen or not going to happen. But with regard to long-term forecasting now with stereo spacecraft, these are two spacecraft that are actually away from the sun-earth line, you know, one leading, one lagging. These spacecraft can give us coronal mass ejections coming at us in great details. We can determine it.
How much warning do we have? Are you talking a month, a year, 10 years?
No. So typically these a cloud of plasma, they're traveling at a speed of, say, between 800 to 2,000 kilometers per second. And so you have between, 3-4 days to sometimes if they're really fast, maybe a day and a half kind of warning.
Okay. Bob Berman, if space weather can have such a big effect on our lives, as Madalika and the caller attested to, why do you think so few people are aware that it even exists? I mean, I suppose that's why you wrote this book. People really hadn't been thinking about these kinds of things. They don't necessarily think about space weather. We certainly think about how hot it's getting.
You're so right, Jackie. And Madalika had the perfect line there in when she said low probability, high impact. When something is low probability year after year after year, like the 100-year floods that you, Jackie, alluded to, you tend to say, well, it's probably not going to happen this year. Plus, there's a generally low science knowledge in the public. There's no way to really say it kindly, but if you were to ask most people to name 3 or 4 basics about the sun, most people could not do that. So I think it's a combination of the two. I also loved what Madalika said concerning the fact that the sun can have storms, flares, coronal mass ejections at any time. The reason we called our book The Sun's Heartbeat is because we love the idea of the pulse, the rhythm, the beating heart of the sun, and that correlates with the number of sunspots and the number of storms and many other things, including effects on Earth. But in truth, they can happen anytime. And that's one reason to be vigilant. It's one reason that all the new spacecraft are so much fun. And we love that people like Madalika are never sleeping in a way and always watching the sun.
I will never pass NOAA again without thinking of you, Madalika. Let's take a call from George. He's calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Welcome to On Point, George.
Yes, hi, Jackie. I have just two-part question for the space weather lady, please. firstly,
Madalika Guhathakurta, our scientist.
Lika, for short.
Lika.
I'm curious where she studied and how one goes about studying space weather. And also, what's the risk to the International Space Station today with this this giant flare that we're talking about?
Let's take the last part of that question first. Thanks so much, George. What's the risk to the space station from today's solar flare, Lika?
I think so. What I didn't get a chance to say is that we on planet Earth are extremely lucky that we are surrounded by our own magnetic field. It's a cocoon, sort of, that surrounds us. We call it the magnetosphere. And so it is true, when a solar storm happens, that storm has to get aligned with Earth's magnetic field. And, you know, something like a magnetic reconnection happens, which allows these particles to penetrate into Earth's magnetosphere. And you know that something like this has happened when you see this beautiful display of auroral light, whether it's the northern or the southern side. And that's when you know that a connection has been made. But if the magnetic field orientation of the solar wind plasma that's coming in the form of coronal mass ejection is not aligned with our magnetic field, they're just really going to kind of go around the magnetosphere, get deflected, and will have no effect on our environment. So our magnetosphere protects us, and the International Space Station is inside the magnetosphere, where it is shielded typically from these kind of activities. Now, if these particles do penetrate, and we know that there is going to be a high level of radiation, we do warn our astronauts at the International Space Station. There are areas which have shielding where we will ask them to go take shelter. If astronauts are doing extravehicular activity, we warn them. So, you know, this, remember I was talking about the Space Weather Prediction Center of NOAA in Boulder, Colorado. They are the ones, they take science data, they take operational data and then provide the nation with forecasting of what is coming at us.
We just have a minute or so left in this segment. He also asked our caller about how you get into something like this, heliophysics. You are the lead scientist for the Living with a Star Initiative. You see more interest in this?
Yes, I'd like to say so much about it, and you can give me a call and I'll tell you more. So heliophysics is a really nascent discipline. We just really created it because we had disparate disciplines, as I was talking about before, really disjointed. And now we have started looking at the whole system together. Sun-Earth couple, Sun-Solar System couple, Sun-Planet-Asteroid. So we have created textbooks. There are three new textbooks. We are actually training, summer school students. In fact, I just came back from one such event. And we are trying to introduce heliophysics as one discipline at universities.
All right.
You can go to any university and study this.
All right. Well, thank you so much for telling us more about it, Lika. Madhulika Guhathakurta, she's lead scientist for NASA's Living with a Star Initiative. Thanks again for joining us. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Sunshine when she's gone. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. Only darkness every day. Ain't no sunshine when she's gone. It's his house, just ain't no home. Anytime she goes away.
This is On Point. I'm Jackie Leiden in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the sun, its changing moods, and its impact on us all. And please check out our website. We have a very dramatic video there of a solar flare. And we're joined this hour by Bob Berman, longtime astronomy columnist and author of the new book, The Sun's Heartbeat and Other Stories from the Life of the Star That Powers Our Planet. And Bob, we've been getting a lot of calls, so I'd like to get to some of them. Harry is calling from Rochester, New York. Welcome to On Point, Harry.
Hi, Jack. How are you doing, Bob?
Quick question Harry.
Here. Mm-hmm. How do you record the temperature of the sun, and actually how hot is the sun? And one more question I forgot, real quick one. There was a scientist on Discovery Channel here a couple of years ago. He said that sunspots have something to do with global warming. Is there any truth to any of that?
Thanks, Harry.
Well, that second part is the big part of the question, but to make it brief, surface of the sun is almost 11,000 degrees Fahrenheit. That's only barely hot enough, by the way, to be totally gaseous, because tungsten, for example, could almost be a liquid, but not quite. And in the center of the sun, where essentially the equivalent of 91 billion H-bombs are going off every second in the core of the sun. And there you're talking about tens of millions of degrees. It's inconceivable. But how the sun is affecting our climate, our weather, are we ready for that one, Jackie?
Let's go there.
All right. Well, that, of course, is the big one, especially since for centuries it looked as if the sun were just responsible for our weather and our changing climate. For example, in that 11-year sunspot cycle, that's why we call it the sun's heartbeat, because the thrust is the rhythms of the sun. And the main one is an 11-year rhythm where sunspots and storms and its actual temperature, its actual emissions increase, and then they decrease. It's an 11-year cycle. So during a 70-year lifespan, the pulse essentially stopped from 1645 to 1750. And when it did, and when the sun went through this long slumber period, Earth got much colder. There was hardship everywhere. The canals of Venice froze over. The Thames froze over that nobody had ever seen before in London. And there was widespread suffering from that. So it really looked as if the sun calls the shots. And this has been we've watched as the sunspot cycle correlates with earthly events of all sorts. The position of the Gulf Stream, that river of ocean water that runs up the East Coast, it shifts according to that 11-year cycle, and all sorts of other things. But then on the other hand, we've been generating a lot of carbon. The rate of carbon in our atmosphere now is about 385 parts per million, up from the 272. That's the natural level that we saw a couple of centuries ago. On every other planet, when you have extra carbon dioxide, you get warmer. And sure enough, we've gotten a degree and a half warmer over the last century or so. So is that what's doing it, or is it the sun? Climate deniers, as I guess they're called, are saying, no, it's just the sun. And they use as an example, this is pretty good, that in the last 10 years, the global warming plateaued. It barely rose during all the 2000s, and it didn't continue going upward the way it had in the 1990s. And that was just the time that the sun went through its amazing deep sleep that no living researcher has ever seen. The sunspot minimum in 2006 to 2009 produced over 800 days without a single spot on the sun. Nobody had ever seen this. No living researcher had ever seen anything like that. The sun was so quiet, so dim, so faint. And just at that time, global warming stopped going up as much. It barely went up. It's called a plateau. But by the way, we're still so high that even then we managed to break all-time records in 2005 and 2010. That joined 1998 as the three hottest years ever measured, even with the plateauing of global warming. So we say, yeah, that's due to the sun. So what's going on? Well, the answer, and I just got this last year, it's part of the research for this book from the climate experts in Boulder, Colorado at NOAA's Climate Center. They finally figured it out. And the puzzle was because we're simple creatures at heart, we humans. We want simple answers to things. We want to know, well, is it human carbon output or is it the sun? And it turns out there are four factors that if you put them all together, they perfectly explain or almost perfectly explain how our climate goes up and down. The four factors are the sun as number one, number two, the climate. And by the way, it's not in that order because climate is a little more important. The carbon that we're throwing in the air has become more important than the sun starting in the 1990s. The sun And then two other things. One is the presence or absence of El Nino. That's that Pacific Ocean warm water phenomenon. And the fourth are volcanoes. If there are a lot of volcanoes in the world that are dustying up our atmosphere, it'll make us cooler. So if you plot all four together, now, for example, in the 2000s, the sun was so quiet, 2006, 7, 8, 9, that it mitigated global warming. So what the sun has really been doing is buying us time. The sun has come to our rescue and stopped global warming from progressing as fast as it otherwise would do. And that's why this new solar cycle, see, they're numbered. The new one, 11-year cycle, just started a couple of years ago. It's number 24. And as it has begun, as the sun has awakened from its slumber, the big question is, will this be a normal cycle? It's going to peak, we think, around the spring of 2013, less than 2 years from now. If it's a normal peak, and if it's followed 2 years later by an El Nino, as it often does, we're going to see the warmest temperatures that humans have ever seen coming up just a few years from now. But if, as most, but not all, solar experts think, the sun is going to have a wimpy peak, if the sun has indeed entered an extended period of low activity, maybe not as low as the Maunder minimum back then in from 1645 to 1715, but an extended peak of low activity, that's the best thing the sun could possibly do for us. It means the current coming maximum will be wimpy, and then the minimum after that may be long and sustained, and it's going to buy us years of barely rising global warming. Of course, what we do at that time is up to us.
Well, I think that David must be very pleased with that answer. It's a fascinating arc, and obviously you are very accustomed to talking to your students about this. Absolutely fascinating. Let's take another call. Steve is calling from West Haven, Connecticut. Welcome to On Point, Steve.
Yes, hello. This is such a good show. I will definitely be up on the internet listening to this show again and telling my friends about it. Thank you for so much information. And I guess that's my question. This show has really, really been good. It's just like one fact after another of what we know about the sun, which kind of makes me ask this question. What is it that we don't know about the sun? What are the sun's mysteries? What is it that we still want to learn about the sun? And a sub question to that question is: would knowing more about how the sun works help us in our goal of getting fusion here on Earth? Because fusion is basically trying to actually have the same type of reaction right here on Earth that the sun does. And I'll get off the air and or off the phone and listen on the radio. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Steve. Well, you know, I'm just thinking, Bob, as Steve was making his point, you yourself did not really get obsessed with this until, you know, relatively late in your career. And I don't know whether it is global warming or the fact that we just want always new frontiers or it's overhead every day. Think about it. We seem to be learning a great deal fairly recently. Witness Matalika's position about the sun.
That's right, of course. And then, and how it affects us. Most people want to know, well, what's in it for me? How the sun's vitamin D? Have we been hiding out from the sun
exactly
too long? And many on the Vitamin D Council, this is a nonprofit organization, says that we've become a race of mole people, that 100 years ago we were generally agrarian. We worked outside. We got lots of sun, and the sun so powerfully generates vitamin D in our bodies that, as you said at the outset, Jackie, just 10 minutes of strong sunlight gives us the same vitamin D production in our bodies as drinking 200 glasses of milk. So why does nature do that so rapidly? Why do we have such an amazing production of vitamin D? The answer, of course, the implied answer is that we are supposed to have a continuous and high level of vitamin D in our bodies, and we don't. One of the reasons is that we're indoors now in our current society. The other is that because of skin cancer, people have been warned and scared about the sun, and when they go out, they put lots of lotion on, which blocks the production of vitamin D. We're behind glass. Glass doesn't allow the sun's ultraviolet in, so then again we'd get no vitamin D. And kids, unfortunately, 20, 30 years ago when they came home from school, parents said, go out and play. Go ahead. Go out and play. And they went to the playground. Not anymore. Playgrounds are often empty as kids come home now, and both perhaps the fear of sexual predators and parents. If a mother says, just go out and play like that, that's almost a social services case.
Well, she might not be thinking about the sun, but you are, because what
yes,
you're
and video games are keeping the kids in. And mm-hmm. so because of this, our vitamin D levels are so low that many are fearing that all sorts of diseases, perhaps even autism, is the unfortunate result of us fearing the sun and avoiding the sun excessively. Of course, I haven't answered Steve's question about what don't we know.
Well, you have a whole book to do that.
Okay.
But I hope he's happy. Let's take another call. Bob is calling from Lee, New Hampshire. Bob, welcome to On Point.
Hello. I had recently heard a report that some stars have been observed giving off jets of water. And I'm wondering if at any time in the sun's history it might have done the same thing, might account for some of the water in the solar system. And the other question was, I understand that the corona or the atmosphere around the sun is actually hotter than the surface of the sun. And if you might comment on those.
Thank you, yep. Bob.
Okay. Yes, sun and water. Not really. We think that water may have come to us via comets, because comets are essentially chunks of water, and they constantly rain down on us, little tiny ones and chunks of them. And there are some ideas that we got our oceans from that. Most stars are surrounded by steam, and that is water vapor. But I've not heard of the sun sending a jet of, you know, concentrated water in our direction. I don't think that's true. I've never encountered that in all the research for the sun's heartbeat. I've never seen that at all. The sun's corona is hot, and that was a puzzle for a long time. Why should the sun's surface be only 11,000 degrees, but its atmosphere extending way, way up be millions of degrees? And that's the beautiful thing we see during a total solar eclipse, that corona, that eerie luminescence in the sky. And we've only recently learned it's all done with magnets. Has to do with the sun's magnetic field and magnetic lines that snap and disconnect and reconnect, generates that fierce heat that surrounds the sun that glows so beautifully during a total solar eclipse. I wish more people could see them. They're pretty rare. People think of partial eclipses, which is where you need eye protection. But in a solar eclipse, you don't need eye protection at all. You can look directly at it. But they're rare.
And then, of course, it'll be overcast. You have a wonderful description here of a scientist running down a road in Africa yes. trying to catch it between the cloud breaks. I want to take at least one more call before we finish the show. David is calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Welcome to On Point, David.
Hi, Jackie. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
My question is, actually, I took an astronomy course in college, and one of the million-dollar questions posed to us was, why does the sun switch its magnetic poles every 4 years? And I've never heard or figured out why that happens, or are we any closer to finding out why that happens?
Thanks, David.
Yeah, we're just learning about the sun and its underlying mechanisms. It's 22 years, by the way, in which it flips its magnetism. Unlike Earth, we reverse our magnetic poles roughly three times every million years, but it's irregular. You never know when it's going to happen next. But every few hundred thousand years on average. The sun does it every 22 years, and it's one of the mysteries we're trying to solve. We just recently, through the satellites that Lika was talking about, the new spacecraft, have been learning more and more about the interior. For example, and Jackie mentioned this at the outset, we only learned, 15 years ago, that there is a sun inside the sun, that there is an interior, the interior 70% of the sun spins as if it were a solid ball. The outer 30% spins chaotically, with the equator taking about a month and then the poles taking an extra 10 days to rotate. And where the two boundaries of these two suns meet, that's where the magnetism is generated. That's what produces all the heat and the coronal mass ejections and all of it starts there. So we're just learning this stuff. We're learning that the sun has pulses. Its surface goes up and down like a giant subwoofer. And there's a whole new field of study called helioseismology that just examines these pulses. And just like we can tell what's under the surface of the Earth by earthquakes, We can find out what's going under the sun because of these movements of the sun's surface, these rapid pulses. So we're just learning. And why it should be 22 years may have something to do with the conveyor belt of material that flows. It's always flowing from the equator toward the poles on the sun and then dives down again. And but we're still learning.
Bob, we have less than 2 minutes left, but I'm just curious. You live near Woodstock. How do you do most of your observation? You've got a couple of dire parables in here about people who look directly at it in medieval times. What would you suggest?
Yes, it's true. The funniest thing was a caller before the 1994 partial eclipse. I was on the radio advising people not to stare at the sun, and one woman called up and said, if the eclipse is so dangerous, why are they having it? The general level is low, and if you want to watch the sun, there are solar filters you can send away for observing it. There are specially made solar telescopes that actually show those beautiful geysers of nuclear flame that shoot from the edges of the sun. And you can see them with fairly expensive special types of solar telescopes. And, of course, since the publisher says, hey, plug the book while
you can read this book.
Yes.
And it is an absolutely delightful one. I'll give it a shout out. The Sun's Heartbeat and Other Stories from the Life of the Star That Powers Our Planet. I think that's the least we can do for all your knowledge, which you've generously shared with us. Thank you.
Thanks, Jackie. I appreciate it.
Thank you. A truly wonderful discussion. And please continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Jackie Lydon, in for Tom Ashbrook. It's been a pleasure. He comes back Monday, and this is On Point.